I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of the payday lenders, people who say they want to give you money.
We cash your personal check and then we hold it till you're paid.
Anytime you have an unexpected expense and need a payday advance, checking to cash can make it happen.
What the people don't tell you when you go to the payday lender is just how much it's going to cost you. Alba Onofrio worked behind the counter at a payday lender.
And so if people would ask, what's the interest rate? I would say, well, I'm not really sure, but you have to pay $20 every 2 weeks.
You wouldn't say it's like 470% or whatever it was,
yeah,
right?
I wouldn't have any idea.
Alba knows that people get hooked on the easy access to cash. That's why state legislatures are cracking down on the check-cashing places. But it is hard for some people to get the money they need when they need it. The trouble with payday lending, a matter of life and debt. That's after the news. So what do you do if you just paid $500 to get your car fixed, and you know you won't have the money in the bank to pay that until the end of the month? Most of us put it on a credit card and worry about what to do when the MasterCard bill arrives. But what if you don't have a credit card? That's when people like Lisa Engelkens wind up at the payday lender, the check-cashing place. These days, Lisa helps other people manage their money, but 10 years ago, she had a low-paying job and she was trying to get by as a single mom.
My daughter at that time would have been 5, so it was just me and her, and child support wasn't really happening for a while. His checks would bounce, which would put me into a bigger hole, and it just got to the point where I was always having to ask my parents for help.
So Lisa walked into a payday lender and signed up for her first loan, $60. But then she went back for another loan and then another, and this went on for a year and then a year and a half. It's how they get you. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Payday lending. It's big business. Last year, they loaned out $45 billion to people who needed that extra bit of cash. And the fees they charge? Close to $5 billion. And it doesn't seem to matter that state legislatures across the country have tried to close down or curtail the activities of payday lenders. They just move across a state line. Others are now using the internet. They always seem to come up with a new way to draw you in, to lend you that bit of money. Lisa Engelkens was working at a temp agency, making $7 an hour. It wasn't enough.
No, I had, car payment, rent. Daycare was the biggest expense. Before and after school care, once she started school. But as far as the rampant shopper or living at the mall, no, that was not me.
So early on when you couldn't make ends meet, your mother would help you out?
Yes, she was always helping me out, especially with daycare or before and after school care, because that was quite expensive.
Was that hard on you, though, borrowing from her?
Yeah, it was, because, you still want to be able to make a way on your own, especially once you're a parent. Prior to having her, it was like, well, that's what parents are supposed to do. But now, being a mom, I wanted to be able to take care of her on my own.
When was the first time you looked at one of these payday lending places or check cashing places as a way of sort of bridging from one paycheck to the other? How did that
come about? When I first, because I always saw the store locations, I always saw the commercials. I never really understood too much as to what they were.
What's check into cash?
It's a remarkable place to get instant emergency cash for a flat fee.
Check into cash.
We cash your personal check and then we hold it till you're paid.
Anytime you have an unexpected expense and need a payday advance, check into cash can make it happen.
What was it about that ad that caught your attention? Do you remember?
Well, I guess they just made it sound like you could just go in there for any reason at all. They weren't going to ask questions like why you needed it or anything like that. So it was just like going to I don't really want to label it as a bank, but...
Yeah, but they're saying it's a remarkable place to get instant cash, right?
And you could get instant cash. I wouldn't necessarily say it was remarkable, though, but yeah.
People from all walks of life have discovered that check into cash offers a simple solution to one of life's most difficult situations.
It's the smart place to get instant emergency cash for a flat fee. Check into cash.
Check into cash.
The word that sticks with me from that ad, Lisa, is it's the smart way to get instant cash.
No, I definitely don't agree with that. But that's the way they make you feel. And like when I went in, it was right down the street. And I went in, and they explained it to me. It was just a piece of cake. You walk in. At that time, they would verify that you were, of course, employed. And all they did at that time, since I was still with the temp agency, they just called the temp agency to verify that I worked there. They call to make sure that your checking account is a valid checking account and that it's not in the negative. Now, it could be zero, but that it was not in the negative. And that you, when you got paid, like you had to give them copies of check stubs or whatever. And then basically after that, it was you just chose what amount you wanted to borrow. And then the amount, they had a poster hung up in the lobby that let you know if you borrow this much, then you write the check out for this much. And then this is the cash that we'll give you today. And then in 2 weeks or whenever your next payday is, they'll deposit that check to reap back the money that you borrowed plus their fee. Nothing was ever explained to me about what an interest rate was, like a disclosure or anything like that, because on paper it would have been like 400%. So they're not going to just jump out and say, oh, yes, come and get this money. You're only paying back 400%.
Let's go back to your very first trip in. You'd mentioned that you were thinking that you needed the money and planning to go in, but was it the sort of thing where you looked over your shoulder to make sure that someone you knew wasn't watching you go in? Was there any kind of shame attached to going to one of these places?
No, I don't think so. But at the same time, I also wasn't telling people what I was doing. It was just a big secret. And later on, after it had all came out and then I started talking to my friends, they were going to the places too.
And they weren't telling you.
And they weren't telling me. So I think that even though I may not have walked in feeling shame, I think there still was some attached to it, especially once you get trapped in it and you feel like you have to go back.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. These days, Lisa Engelkins is advising people how to manage their finances. And she gets to tell people her own story, how she was once in exactly the same position.
The very first time I went, all I wanted to try was just to borrow the $60, and then I wrote the check for $70.69. So the fee was the $10.69.
And do they cash that check right away, or do they hold
no,
it
they
until
hold
your paycheck
it,
comes in?
Because basically you're going in and you're writing a bad check. Because if you don't have
Have that money in your account right now, or you'd be getting it out of your
right,
own
bank. Right, exactly.
Okay.
And what they do is they'll hold it until your next payday. And that's why they have to verify when you get paid, so that they can actually know exactly when to deposit that check. And it was all done electronically every 2 weeks when I got paid.
First time, you're thinking to yourself, this isn't so bad. I got the cash.
Yep, that's exactly how I felt. And then after that $70 was taken out of my checking account, the next time I got paid, well, then that left me $70 short.
So did you feel in some way like you had to go back a week or 2 weeks later in order to bridge yourself to the next?
And that's what I did.
How long did it go on?
I started in August of 1998, and every 2 weeks until December of 1999.
Wow, that's like a year and a half, right? And the amount
was
would
huge.
In some way get bigger and bigger each time. Right.
Right. 2 or 3 weeks into it, I was in the full amount, because at that time you could only take the maximum, which was you would actually get $255 in cash, but you would be writing your check for $300. So every month I was throwing away $90 in fees.
It's interesting the way they set it up, though, Lisa. They talk about it, and you use the same language. It's a fee for borrowing the money. They don't put it in terms of interest
exactly.
rates,
exactly. And that's how it is advertised. That's how it was on the poster in the lobby. That is your fee. I didn't even think about it as interest. And the way that it was presented was fee, so I was fine with that. Well, I think now if they would have said 400%, I think I might have had a red flag, because that's a very large number.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, annual percentage rate or interest rate or anything like that, I don't think that would have probably made me turn around and go back out the door.
What was it, Lisa, that finally got your attention? I mean, you've been doing this for a year and a half. Was there a moment when you thought, wait a minute?
Yeah, nothing was getting better. It was getting worse. I was stressed out. I mean, I was going to work downtown, would leave my job every pay period. As soon as that check was cashed out of my checking account, go back to the place, get another loan to put it back into my account so that I could continue to pay my bills. So I was running myself crazy. And I did that every 2 weeks for that period of time.
And were you thinking to yourself, okay, I can't buy new clothes for Sierra. I'm going to have to borrow money from my mother after all. That sort of thing? Is that going on?
Yeah, and I think I probably still was asking for help. And eventually my mom, I think eventually then she said, what is going on? And I finally told her. I admitted that I was in one of these places. And then she explained it to me. And I was like, oh, okay. No wonder.
Do you remember the conversation with your mother? I mean, was it a hard one for you?
No, actually, I was almost relieved because then it made sense as to why I wasn't getting ahead, why I wasn't on time, why I was still... She even explained it to me as a loan shark because years and years and years ago, somewhere that she or my father worked, they would have people standing outside of this gate when people would get off work. And they would cash their checks for them, of course, for a big fee. And, I mean, she explained it to me that way as loan sharking. And then as you think about it, that's really what it is. It's just legalized loan sharking.
But once you're so far down that loan shark rabbit hole, how do you get out? Did you say, Mom, I'm going to need $600, you know, to get...
No, actually, we discussed it, and I was going to, before the check cleared... which was tricky because I had to time it just right, I went and withdrew everything out of my checking account and allowed the check to bounce. That was the only way I knew how to get out of it. And I'm not saying that that's the way everyone should go. And I ended up losing my checking account over it as well because then, of course, I owed the bank money for all the NSF fees because I stopped my direct deposit. I made sure nothing was going in that account so that they could never get that money. And then, but I did go back and pay that debt back.
You did pay them eventually?
Yes, I did. I paid them back 3 years later from a tax refund, and it took them forever to find my account to even pay them back. But
I didn't up on
but I didn't want it to come back and haunt me.
In the year and a half that you paid all these fees and with the amount of money that you owed at the end, did you ever get out a calculator and figure out in total what you paid these guys over that period of time?
In that period of time, just for the loans that I actually could get a recording of, not including the other place that I was in, $1,243.48.
That's the fees.
That was just fees.
Lisa Engelkens now works as a credit counselor in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. In just a moment, we're going to step to the other side of that thick glass window. Alba Onofrio worked for a number of years handing out the cash at a payday lending place. She met people who felt that they had no alternative, and she got to know a number of them.
Occasionally somebody would call and say, oh, I'm due to pay today, but I'm really busy or I don't have a car, something came up, can I come in tomorrow? And so we would say, well, I can put it off till 11, but you have to be here before 11 to get that payment in or else it goes to the bank.
Surviving a personal credit crunch. I'll ask Alba if there is a place for the payday lender. That's up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Amid all this recent talk of a looming recession comes the risk that such a downturn poses for people who live from paycheck to paycheck. And what's bad news for most of us is just the sort of thing that payday lenders will try to capitalize on.
We've all been there. You need cash fast.
My old car had 250,000 miles on it, and my wife was embarrassed to be seen in it. So we went to check into cash, and 10 minutes later, I had my down payment.
When Alba Onofrio was in college, she got a job at one of these payday lending places, and it was her work to approve people's request for money. And it wasn't the sort of thing that required a lot of training.
I would stand behind a colleague and kind of hear how she did it, and I would kind of copy that. And I can remember being the only one of the maybe 6 or 7 people who worked in this office who had ever read the documents that we gave to people. But I thought, well, if I'm giving them to people and telling them to sign on this X and this X and this line, I should at least know what it says.
You did read the fine print.
I did read the fine print, being, you know, the studious, innocent college student that I was. And I didn't really understand it, but it did have an interest rate that was, you know, huge. But it was And so if people would ask, what's the interest rate? I would say, well, I'm not really sure, but you have to pay $20 every 2 weeks.
You wouldn't say it's like 470% or whatever it was,
yeah,
right?
I wouldn't have any idea. I would just say, I would probably have even said, it's not a rate. It's you have to pay $20 per 200.
It's a fee.
Right. It's like a fee. Exactly.
Alba says for her, it was a pretty good job. During the slow hours, she got her studying done, and she was also able to use her Spanish when Latino customers came in. But around the time that Alba worked there, that was when various state legislatures started tightening the laws on such lending. I asked Alba if she knew that what she was doing was so controversial.
No, I really didn't. I mean, I was good with money, and it was a place that cash checks did kind of money wiring, transferring, bill pay, and then, you know, payday lending. And so I knew I was really good with money and really good with numbers. So I thought that's a perfect kind of thing for me. But no idea of any of the politics behind it or what it meant or any of that stuff.
Now, tell me a little bit about the place where you work, because some of these places I see have, you know, basically chain link hanging over all the glass on the outside and they're kind of seedy. What about the place where you were working?
We're on one of the main roads, a couple blocks from the mall. We had definitely, I think, 2-inch thick bulletproof glass that we were behind, very much like a bank and kind of the way that you come in and out of the office, just because we would hold, you know, up to $30,000 in cash at any given time.
What did it end up being? What was the bulk of the work that you were doing at this place?
Always on Fridays, we're mostly check cashing, because that's when lots of people got paid, very busy. Through the week, it was more payroll advance and money transfers. It's funny you ask, because I'm thinking 5 years later, how do I still have all this stuff in my head? But I guess you just it just gets in there.
It becomes automatic.
Government checks are the hardest to forge, so those were the easiest to cash for us. And so they had the smallest commission rate, which was around 2%.
Right.
But a handwritten person-to-person check was 10%, for example. And so it changed throughout depending on the signature, what the check was look like, whether it was officially issued or handwritten and that kind of stuff. So it varied between 2% and 10% to cash a check.
Were you surprised at the amount of payday lending that took place at this check cashing store where you worked?
Well, I didn't know what payday lending was before I went, so I had nothing to kind of base it off of. I wasn't really surprised because I didn't really know what it should be or even what that really meant for people.
Now, there can be people listening to us who also don't know what payday lending is. So mm-hmm. What's the kind of idiot's guide to how it works?
Well, the basic essence is that if you don't have enough money, enough cash to get you to your next payday, if you have a stable job and you have proof that income is going to be coming in and going out, that kind of thing, then you can get an advance on your paycheck, meaning you can get some cash based on what you will be paid in the next 2 weeks.
So what do I have to do then, Alba? I come in and I say, I'm going to be paid on Friday, but it's Tuesday, I'm broke, mm-hmm. I need $200 to make it to the end of the week. Is that a normal kind of request?
Yeah. You would have to write us a check to kind of guarantee that you were going to pay us back for $220, but you would get $200 in cash. So you have a choice of either coming in 2 weeks and giving us $220 cash, and
right.
then you get your checks back, or we can just deposit the checks if it went into your bank account.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Alba Onofrio worked for 5 years at a payday lending establishment, a check cashing place. Alba says she learned quickly that the lender was actually a key part of the community. She says she had all kinds of people come in. One of them, a veteran, came in regularly to get an advance on his Social Security check.
I know that he took public transportation. He was dressed very modestly, and he would always come in right before the check was due to come in, and he wouldn't be there every month, but on a fairly regular basis, he would come in. And I always remember him talking about what he needed the money for being the most basic necessities. I mean, shelter, food, medicine. Never, ever heard him speak of anything like travel or Christmas present, nothing. It was always, I have to have this to pay the rent or to pay, you know, the light bill or to get food. And I just remember thinking that it must be horrible to not have that social network to just help you get by that little bit. And so he really would come in every month or every other month or every couple months and take out $200, and in 2 weeks, we would deposit his check for $220, and that would be it.
And so here's someone who is taking advantage of a service, if you want to call it that, in the neighborhood, and he'd be in trouble. He'd be in much more trouble if it wasn't there, right?
Right.
Did you see people, people who were getting messed up by always wanting that advance, by always, you know, coming in to get that little bit extra? Did you see it also hurting people?
Well, I remember distinctly this one younger man and his mother, and it would just break your heart. You know, it would just kill me to see these people come in. And she had a very steady, not very high paying, but very steady job. And they would come in together happy as they could be, and she would say, I want to take out a loan. And we would know as soon as they walked through the door that she was taking out a loan to give her son, who was a grown man himself, for some useless purpose like drugs or alcohol. I mean, you just knew it. You knew by the interaction between what they talked about and how they talked and how jittery he was. And I knew that in the 2 weeks, she would be paying back that money and not him. And so we would go through the whole process, and I would say, you understand that if you sign these papers, it's based on your paychecks and your
check. You're talking to the mother at this time.
I'm talking to the mother because I didn't have anything to do with the son because he wasn't my customer.
And it wasn't his check,
and
right?
It wasn't his check. And so talking to the mom about if you get this advance, you're writing the checks from your bank account. You will be responsible for paying the $20 every 2 weeks or coming in and paying it off. Or if you don't come in and pay, over and over and over and over. I mean, as far in detail and as cumbersome as I could make it for her to understand what was going on, she would agree, and yes, I understand, that makes sense. And I swear they wouldn't have even turned around from that counter before she would take that $200 and hand it all over to that son. And it would just break my heart, and it just killed me. And it was just those kinds of situations where you just knew that this was her borrowing money that she didn't have to give to her son for something that he shouldn't even be using the money for, and she was going to be taking on that extra burden.
He was just taking advantage of the fact that he could play the I'm your favorite son card with her, right?
Yeah, or if you love me, you know, I really need this. And at some point, you've got to say, she's a big girl. I've got to do my job. I can be as honest and direct and as clear as I can, but I can't pass judgment on them because I don't know what it's like to be in their shoes.
Did you see people getting caught up in this, though, where they had to come back week after week, borrowing more money to pay the interest on the money that they borrowed, that sort of thing? I mean, did you see it becoming a trap for anyone?
I think that people do get stuck in the rhythm. For a lot of people, it turned into another bill like the telephone bill. You come in every 2 weeks and pay $20. You come in every 2 weeks and pay $20, just like you come in every month and pay your telephone bill. And so in that sense, it wasn't getting shorter and shorter. It was just about you're paying $20 to hold on to the same $200 over time. And lots of times people would bounce checks or something like that, and then they would have to pay them off over time. And that kind of forced people. They wound up paying a lot more money, but it forced them to kind of break the cycle because you weren't allowed to get another advance until you paid off your last one.
The thing about it that gets me is that all these people already have an account, a checking account at a bank, but they end up at this check cashing place, this payday lending place, to get a little bit of money. I guess because they can't go to their own bank for a loan of whatever they want, $200 or $300, right?
Right.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. We're talking about the way that people come to rely on the high-rate loans at the payday lender. Alba Onofrio worked at one such place, and she wound up concluding that despite what she'd been told, there were some people who need this system to get by.
Because at school, I would learn about this amoral behavior and the market trying to take advantage. And then I would go to work on Friday night and see a lot different story, a lot more complicated story, a lot grayer issue. And so I also volunteered for local nonprofits who were completely opposed to payday lending. And I agreed with what they were saying. But at the same time, I felt like, where else would they go? If I were in that situation, where would I go? And I couldn't think of any place that I knew of that was available to everyone. And that's really hard because when people would come in, oftentimes, you know, they would tell you their story and you'd listen and sympathize with them, especially if you'd known them because they'd come in before. And I couldn't solve their problem, but I could do a little minor Band-Aid, a little relief at the moment when it was most urgent or when the crisis was greatest. And so thinking about if that were to stop without that cushion somewhere else, it doesn't make any sense to me. And so I often would have these discussions about, I completely agree with you that we shouldn't be charging exorbitant interest to folks who most need the resources. But at the same time, if you yank out that rug and have no substitute in place, what does that mean for these people immediately following?
Yeah, they're going to borrow money from some guy on a street corner who's going to charge them twice as much.
Right, or pawn what? Your baby stroller? I mean, what do you do in those situations? I mean, there's got to be some sort of answer, either with the banks or with local nonprofits or something, where people can go and say, I need a couple hundred bucks for a very short amount of time. Unfortunately, when you let the market take on that role, they have to make money, and they make money hand over fist.
Here's an example of how payday lenders adapt to changes in the law. Alba Onofrio was working at such a check cashing place when the state laws changed. Payday lending was suddenly illegal. Alba says the owners didn't miss a beat. They just began peddling a kind of bogus internet hookup service.
They didn't ever change the sign. So I don't know if there was a rule, but we had the sign. The sign had been up for years. And when the laws changed, the sign still said payday lending, even though when they would come in and say, I want a payday loan, I would say, you know, we don't do payday lending anymore. There's no loans. North Carolina has outlawed that, so we're not allowed to anymore. What we have now is... And then I would start the spiel about how you could sign up for a year's worth of internet service, and then you would get an instant $200, $400, or $600 rebate.
And I'd stop you right there and say, I don't even have a computer. Why do I want internet service?
And I would say, well, that's very true. The only way that you can get cash from me today is through signing up for internet service.
And I go, okay, so I sign up for internet service.
Yes.
What does it cost me?
So today, all you get is money. Today, you would get your $200 and you would write me a check for $220.
Just like the old payday lending.
Exactly like the old payday lending. So I remember during the switchover, people would be like, but I don't have a computer. I don't want internet service. I just want money. And I would have to say, the only way I can give you money is this. The old system is gone. It's illegal. Now we have another system. It works in essence. You will still get $200, but you have to sign up for internet service. And they would say, well, do I have to use it? And I would say, I don't care what you do with internet service, because most people, especially in that socioeconomic bracket, didn't have computers, didn't know what to do with them, even if they did have them, much less internet service. And I think maybe out of the entire time that I did it, one or two people would call in and say, I'm trying to install the CD on my computer and it's not working. And I would give them the helpline for some number.
There wasn't really any internet service, was there?
Well, at some point there had to have been, but I certainly couldn't troubleshoot with people. And I just gave them this 800 number. And I actually did have to call the 800 number sometimes to get help. But, you know, it was a very complicated and not clear-cut kind of, we should install a cable box and now you have internet kind of service. So how cumbersome it was for people, I'm sure, was much more than it was worth for the vast majority of people who didn't even have a computer.
Now, I've heard recently that the offering of the internet service with the rebate and the extra money and you pay this and this has also been outlawed. I'm left thinking, after talking with you, I'm left thinking they're just going to figure out a new way of getting money into people's hands, right?
I wouldn't doubt it.
Alba Onofrio used to work at a payday lender. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Earlier this hour, I was talking with Lisa Engelkins. Lisa's one of these people who got drawn into debt by relying too much on this kind of easy access to cash. She says the real trouble ahead is what we'll all find in our email accounts.
Now the internet is huge. Just checking my email every day, I have junk mail that from all kinds of payday lenders. And that's what I'm hearing, too, from a lot of prospective clients, are that they are now the payday loans online that they're getting stuck in or that they're now trying to collect for.
But the place that's beside the pawn shop that's going to actually hand me $320
bills is different from
the internet. How's the internet getting cash to people who need it right now? I mean, have they figured out a way of doing
that? Into
their
bank accounts, direct deposit, which means you're giving someone, a faceless person, bank information over the internet, which already is a double no-no.
I was going to say, this is even worse than that.
Exactly. So you're providing that information, personal information, and a lot of them, there's no paper involved at all. It's completely electronic.
And I was thinking earlier when you were talking about how your mother and father remember people standing outside the plant ready to cash the check for a fee. we're coming up to that time of year where people are being lured by the same kind of thing with tax refund time.
Yep.
Is that...
That's another thing that, to me, is also predatory, is the rapid anticipation loans, which at least now I think they have to classify it as a loan and not that you're getting... Because it's not your actual refund you're getting back. It's just a loan from the place. And people don't realize
a
whole lot. So even though we talk about payday lenders being, you know, the huge, big, predatory bad guy... The bad guys are the credit card companies, some of the finance companies. I mean, it's everywhere. Consumers are being trapped in all kinds of high interest rate transactions, period.
Are you the one who gives Sierra her financial advice on how to manage money?
Well, I may not give it to her quite like she probably should, but she knows, because that's another thing. Like when I was growing up, you never heard your parents talk about money problems or if things were tight. Now, oh, if I don't have it, Sierra knows it. I tell her, I'm like, I don't have it. You're going to have to wait, whatever the case may be. Try and just let her know that sometimes you can't always get what you want.
You ever tell Sierra about your time with the payday lenders?
Yeah, she knows I'm here today. She knows all about it. And the funny thing is that when she was younger, the one that was down the street, they actually came into my neighborhood.
This is the payday lending place?
The payday lending place. It was like American Check Cashers or something. And they dropped off in everybody's driveway a bag, a marketing bag, with pens, pads of paper, with their logo and name on it.
Like a loot bag to draw you in.
And she came running the house because she was like, look, Mom, we got all this free stuff. I was like, it's going in the trash.
That's Lisa Engelken. She joined me here in our Chapel Hill studio. My other guest, Alba Onofrio, works on social justice issues with Latinos, and she's not quite as committed as Lisa to shuttering all the check cashing stores. That is, not until there are some reasonable alternatives in place. That's up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Across the country, legislators are thinking up ways to restrain the growth of payday lending. These are the little quick cash places where people will pay an unusually high rate of interest, sometimes up to 400%, so they can get an advance on their paycheck. And yet, despite the lawmakers' efforts, there are still upwards of 20,000 such places still in operation. Alba Onofrio used to work in one. Since she left, she's thought a lot about better ways to help people get that quick shot of cash when they need it most. She says a credit union in North Carolina has come up with a creative idea.
What I understand is they do the exact same model. 200 cash and you pay 225. But the 25 that you pay back, instead of it going as profit to the company, it gets put in a savings account. And so every time...
For you. Oh, okay.
And so then every time you do it, another $25, for example, goes into that account and keeps going into that account. And eventually, you have $200 in that account, and now it's forgiven. You've paid into it enough times that now you're square. So I really think that there's a role for our local banks to play in kind of understanding what the needs are of their clients, not just the clients who have thousands and thousands of dollars, but the low-income folks who are going to be right around zero for a lot of the months. You know, it's just a very hard balance that you have to strike, because if it's left to the market will charge as much as the customer can bear. And that's what's happening now, is that 20 bucks every 2 weeks that gets compounded goes right to the owners.
You've seen this business from both sides of the glass. If you were short a little cash, would you go into one of these places as well?
I feel like I'm lucky enough to have credit. And so I would use things like my credit card or savings or whatever I've been able to to build up over time. But given a situation where I didn't have access to credit or I didn't have any money, absolutely. And that's why it was such a humbling experience for me. It's like, I see myself in these people. I could be this. I come from very humble beginnings and I still live pretty modestly. And so if that were me, and if I were head of household, even more so, pride is, you know, when you don't have much, pride is something you cling to. And for me, I could see myself in that same situation of, before I would go and ask family for money, I would happily pay somebody a fee of you know, what I consider pretty reasonable, 20, 40, 60, whatever, I would happily pay whatever they ask me to be able to maintain that dignity and for it to be something that happened between me and my banking institution, even though that may be a check cashing store or payroll advance place, as opposed to everybody in the family knowing or everybody in the church knowing or seeing me at the local pawn shop. You know, it means something. And I think for a lot of families, it means something when you don't have much.
Alba Onofrio now works helping Latino immigrants with social justice issues. She says the answer to payday lending is not just closing the places down. She says they'll go away on their own if the banks and credit unions find creative ways to help people with short-term, small cash loans. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. If you have that kind of personal insight into solving economic difficulties or a story of your own about how you got into or out of trouble, I'd like to hear from you. You can find me at our website. I am at thestory.org. Now, we're also always on the lookout for stories that fit into our file called Your Story. You know, that horrible mistake you made on your first day on the new job, or an unexpected encounter with an unusual person. Colleen Barbas wrote to tell me about a long-anticipated trip to Chile and the death of her grandfather and a series of misadventures that seem to connect the two.
He was a rock. He was a protector. And family was just really important to him. My parents told me a story about during the Watergate scandal. He and my dad disagreed vehemently about Nixon. I think my grandpap had voted for Nixon because he ran along the Republican line. And not until my grandpap learned that Nixon had lied to his wife and his kids did he change his mind. He changed his mind when he found out that he put his office and, you know, everything else in front of his family.
Don't mess with family.
Yeah, don't mess with family. That was kind of the number one thing for him.
And Colleen very clearly remembers the day when she heard that her grandfather was dying of cancer. Her sister was the one who told her.
One day she stopped by my work, and I came out, and she didn't look her usual cheery self. And I knew something was the matter, so she took me to, like, a bench just outside of my office and told me that he had been diagnosed with terminal leukemia. And I actually screamed, like, yelled, no, as loudly as I imagined I could yell. And I never thought that would be my reaction. It was like the movies. You know what I mean? It just came out of me like this real, utter regret and remorse for my sick grandpa. And that was kind of when I started thinking, well, I can't go to Chile. You know, our family all just kind of gathered around, and I just kind of told them, there's no way I can go. I'm going to call the airline on Monday and cancel the trip. And everyone said, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. You've been saving. You've wanted to do this for so long. And the way that convinced me was what my dad said, that Grandpap worked his whole life for his family to have things like trips to Chile, to see places that you never thought you could see and meet people that you never thought you could meet. And, you know, this was an experience that he would have taken if he had the chance at my age.
I understand it. I would have been persuaded by my father saying the same sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
How hard was it to say goodbye to your grandfather?
Oh, it was kind of heartbreaking. Just because I knew that once I got on that plane, there was a chance I wasn't going to see him again. But we had an early Christmas, and the day after that, we were sitting at Nana and Grandpap's house, and Grandpap was in his chair, his, you know, easy chair, and I kind of went and sat on the ottoman at his feet, basically, and just kind of put my head in his lap, and he kind of said, you grandkids are great. And I told him, well, we come from good stock. And I think that was kind of, for me, in my heart, like my official goodbye to Grandpap.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Colleen Barbas left for Chile. There were four of them on the trip, Colleen and her Chilean boyfriend Rodrigo, Colleen's friend Andre and her boyfriend, and they were a half-day's drive from the capital Santiago, and they had a cell phone so they could stay in touch with the folks at home.
Rod had the phone, and the phone rang, and he answered, and I started to cry, because I knew then what it meant. And he gave the phone to me, and I talked to my mom, and she was just really sweet and really gentle, letting me know kind of how he passed. And I said, well, should I fly home? Should I go to the airport right now? What should I do? And she said, no, stay in Chile. Enjoy your trip. You know, all we're doing here is crying and eating. So, you know, you would just be joining in. And
have a cry, get something to eat.
And I did just that, you know. So I joined them from a distance, basically, crying and eating.
But at this point, you wanted to, what, get back to Santiago?
When Rod answered the phone, we were actually in the car, driving out of the center of La Serena and taking Ruta 5, which is the one and only highway, basically, in Chile that just travels north and south. Mm-hmm. And we were heading south, back towards Santiago. I think from La Serena to Santiago, it's about 6 or 7 hours. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a pretty long drive.
How did the trip go?
Well, not well. as we were driving, it was about dusk. I think we were a couple hours from La Serena at this point. And we were kind of coming over a hill on Ruta 5. And Andrea was driving, and all of a sudden she says, well, what's going on? What is this? What's happening? And Rod and I both look up, and there's just a guy, a man, standing in the middle of the road with reflector sticks and just kind of flashing them at us. I mean, in the middle of the highway. And we were like, oh my gosh, what is this man doing? And Andrea's like, should I go around him? What should I be doing? And Rodrigo said, oh, that's right. This is how they pull you over on the highway. And
oh, this is a policeman?
Yes.
Okay.
And we kind of all looked at him like, no, you have to be wrong. This is insane. Why would he stand in the middle of the street when he can have a car or, you know, I don't know, a flare gun or something? So yeah. Rod said, no, there's stations along the highway, and they basically watch cars, and if they have something wrong, if they're speeding or something, they just stand in the street. So Andrea said, well, should I pull over? What should I do? And he said, yeah, pull over. So we pulled over, and the only word that I could really make out was infracción. And I'm thinking, okay, that's probably infraction, and we did something wrong. And the conversation seemed to take a very long time. And also, he was basically hip height to our faces, and he had this big wooden-handled pistol right at his hip, you know, so I'm just staring at this gun, hearing him say infracción over and over again, and just getting really nervous because I'm not understanding what's going on. And finally, he just kind of taps the hood and walks away. And we all look at Rodrigo and say, what's going on? What happened? And he said, oh, our headlight bulb has burned out. And we were like, that's it? And he said, yeah, no. And he said that if we don't get it fixed, then we'll definitely get pulled over. So we got off and went to the service station that he instructed us to go to, but it was closed. And there was another one across the street. And the guy at that service station said they didn't have bulbs, but if you go back across the street and knock on the door, he will open the place. So we knocked, and there was no one there. And the guy said, oh, that's right, he's eating here at the restaurant. Just go to the first booth and ask the guy at the first booth to go open up his gas station. And Rod was kind of like, okay, I guess I'll go disturb this guy's dinner and ask him to open up his gas station. But he did. I mean, he was really nice about it. And so we headed back out onto the road. And at this point, it's, you know, pitch black.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Colleen Barbas is telling us about her grandfather's death and a series of coincidental misadventures that seem somehow to be connected. At this point, on the day that she heard that her grandfather had died, she and three friends are in a car on their way back to the house that they're staying in Santiago. And for some unaccountable reason, it seems they keep getting delayed.
We get towards Santiago and start to see the lights of the city, you know, ahead of us in the distance. And we keep looking for the exit that says Alameda. And we're not seeing it, and we're not seeing it. And then we realize that the lights of Santiago are now behind us. So something was amiss, and we got out our map. So we're going about probably 30 miles an hour with our map and our dome light on and trying to figure out where we are and what we're doing. And we eventually found Alameda, which was miraculous, to say the least, because we were just traveling blind, it felt like, to me anyway. And found Alameda, found our way back to Rod's aunt's house, And he unlocked the gate and unlocked the door.
What time of the night or morning is it at this point?
I think it's about 2, I would say, in the morning.
And you were expected there like 9 or 10 o'clock, right?
Well, we were actually going to an empty house around New Year's. Most Santiago residents go to the coast for their holiday. So, you know, Santiago was pretty empty and his aunt's house was totally empty.
You'd been expecting to be there, though, what, 9, 10 o'clock at night?
Yeah. Yes, okay. Yeah. So, yeah, I would say it was about 2 in the morning at this point, and Rodrigo was on the couch in the living room, I think leaving a message for his mother at this point, saying everything looked un poco extraño, which means a little strange. And when he said that, I kind of started to look around and realized that there had been, I mean, when we left that house a few days ago, there were wrapped Christmas presents, and everything was in order. I mean, everything looked, you know, nice. It was a nice, tidy house, and we come back, and the Christmas presents are unwrapped. The paper is all over the floor. There are lamps on the floor, and all the kitchen cupboards and drawers were open. And I ventured upstairs to where our bedroom was just to drop off the suitcase, and there was a bureau in the hallway that had been tipped over and was blocking the staircase, basically. Huh. And all of its contents were scattered. I managed to kind of climb over this bureau and go into the bathroom and saw that the glass of the window was broken, that shattered. And
the outside window, right? So somebody had come in through there?
Right. Yeah. And as soon as I saw that, I scurried back downstairs and sat very closely to Rodrigo as he was now talking to his mom on the phone, basically trying to decide what to do. We were thinking, should we just go and stay at the hotel? Do we feel safe here? What should we do? But we decided to stay because at this point it's 4 in the morning. We were just exhausted, you know? So we locked all the windows, you know, sweltering. I mean, that made the room very, very hot. And Rod had grabbed a couple of kitchen knives, and I had been the holder of everybody's passports for the last few days. I just had them all in my luggage.
Yeah.
So I was kind of clutching them in my sleep.
Ready,
you know,
for a fast getaway.
Yeah, for a fast getaway. If the robbers came back, you know, they never go for something that you were clutching as though it's obviously valuable, you know. But in my
mind, take everything but this.
Yeah, don't take this. You don't want this, trust me. And
was there any indication, Colleen, when this had happened? I mean, did it look like the stuff had been blowing around for a couple of days, or did it look like the guys had just been there? What were you thinking?
We actually found out a couple days later that the robbery took place the night of our trip. And all of the things that happened basically delayed us possibly walking into two guys or girls or whoever with knives.
So the conclusion of the people there was that the robbery was probably going on at about the time when you should have been pulling in, right?
At dark. I mean, they would have waited until dark, according to the police, and then it's very likely that we could have walked in on them robbing the house.
This is quite a day for you. It begins with news that your grandfather died, and then you this like comic series of attempts to try and get home, and then this.
Yeah, I mean, the day was just about, I would say, the longest day of my life.
You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. But how? I asked Colleen, how does all this connect back to her grandfather?
Well, you know, a few days later, I was talking to my folks again about how everyone was doing, how the arrangements were going with my grandfather. And that's when it kind of struck me. It seemed like a really major coincidence that the day I found out that my grandfather had passed was the same day that all of these things happened to basically keep us from walking in on two robbers. And if my grandpa were capable of playing that role of protector, even in this other life, basically, he would do it. You know, bust a headlight, get us lost, like cover up an exit sign. Because, you know, A, he was the protector, and B, he had a good sense of humor. So I think he would kind of also get a chuckle, like, watching us take this trip that should have been 6 hours that turned into about 10 hours, I think. And, you know, I'm not a religious person, but it really just struck me, the idea that, like, I really think my grandpap was there.
And was it, like, a good explanation for a sequence of events, or do you think that it actually might be true?
In my heart, I think it's true. Knowing my grandpap and knowing what kind of man he was and knowing how important family was, in my heart, it's true. I was reluctant to tell other people about how I felt about it because I didn't want it to be spoiled, you know, with logic. I'm not always a very logical person, and it takes other people to sort of make me see things in a rational light a lot of time. But Rodrigo, on the other hand, is a very logical person. He likes to play the devil's advocate in a lot of situations, so I held off telling him for a few more days, I think, until we got back to the States. And then just in talking about my grandpap, I kind of said, well, I think everything that happened that night on our way to Santiago happened because of grandpap. I really do. And he just said, knowing your grandpap, if he had the power to do that, I believe he would have. And that was really sweet to hear.
That kind of sealed it for you then.
Mr. Logic was able to admit it too, you know. That was really nice. So, yeah. To me, it's true. Grandpap was there.
Colleen Barbers wrote to me with her story and then stopped by the radio studio in Chicago to talk about it with me. From there, you can do exactly the same thing. If you have a favorite story that you'd like to share, just send me a couple of lines. We'll take care of the rest. Full service, concierge, storytelling. Doesn't get any better. You can find me at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.